Hello, this is the podcast for our class last evening, and it was on Monday, September 20th, and we're continuing to talk about affirmative duties. And remember, duties are our threshold question now in our cause of action for negligence, and it's a very high standard to meet. And I keep saying this, but I say it continually say it for a reason, because a very, very common problem with students is you immediately say, well, of course they had a duty, and start talking about reasonable care, even though you don't realize you're doing that. So I want to stress that duty has to be your preliminary inquiry. It has to always question, are they doing something? Was it something that they had a responsibility to do, and they were just doing it unreasonably? That's misfeasance. Or should they have done something more? And on many occasions, we have people who behaved unreasonably, but they had no duty of care otherwise. And so, unless there was a duty in some way, and everything that we're talking about now is either creating a duty or saying there's no duty. Unless there was a duty of care owed to another person, for here we're talking about our concept of duty, for that you had a responsibility to do something else. Unless there was a duty of care owed, your behavior is irrelevant. So duty is a very, very much of a policy question, very, very much of a question of law. Courts do not want to expand this duty concept, because by expanding the concept of duty, you expand tort liability. And that's never been the policy in our country. I know there's this school of thought or non-thought that, oh, you know, tort system's ruining America and there's liability everywhere. That's just not true. And I hope you're seeing this as we go along, seeing how difficult it is actually to get a case into court. You can sue as much as you want. You can bring a case as much as you want. But there are many, many, many obstacles to it going forward. Duty is the one we're concentrating on now. So we see Farwell v. Keaton. And it's a confusing case, and I think you handled it well in class. The main issue here was the common law establishment of a duty through his beginning to it's taking steps to aid his coming back to the scene of the fight, his giving him some help, all of that stuff, I think perhaps, and the court certainly agreed, was sufficient to create a duty of care. The question of reasonable care comes into it secondarily. Maybe he does behave reasonably. He left him on the neighbor's, you know, on the grandparents or parents' doorstep. So, you know, that's a second question. But did he have a duty of care to his friend? Court said because he voluntarily assumed a duty, he had a duty of reasonable care. The language, I want to stress the language of special relationships. It's unnecessary and I think improper. And so did the two dissenters. We had, you know, this isn't an overwhelming thing. We had three majority, two people who took no part, and two dissenters. So I would have probably concurred, which is, you know, I agree with the result, but don't agree with the reasoning. Why did they talk about special relationship? Maybe they were trying to get it more into the consciousness of our common law that the social relationship had some legal ramifications. I doubt it hasn't gone that far. And in fact, whenever you start to thinking about social relationship versus special relationship, I read you that case for a reason. That was William and Barbara out on their second date. She, which went bad, she now is claiming that he was responsible for her safety, for putting, he put her on a bad horse, he should have come back for her, blah, blah, blah. And the court said, no, the date gone bad. Second, they were, yes, they were out on a social relationship. They had a, they'd had, you know, their second date. They were out on a date during the date, and still no special relationship imputing a duty. So, again, whenever you want to kind of go off looking for duty, looking for a responsibility, you know, draw yourself back and think critically about it. I pointed out the Moat case here on page 146. Go and look at it. It's just a note case. We used to read the whole thing, but now it was down to a note, and it's starting to talk about nonfeasance versus misfeasance in a third-party concept, and it introduces the notion of when are you responsible for injuries of a third party that you don't even know or had no role in doing anything. It's responsible for injuries to a third party. And here we had a homeowner who... his property was on fire when he tried to put out the fire with water. Turns out no water pressure. He sues the water company. The company said, I had no duty to give you water pressure. My responsibility, my contract was with the city, and my only responsibility is to the city. Cardozo talks about misfeasance versus nonfeasance. It wasn't misfeasance. They didn't do a bad job. It was just they failed to supply the water. I think that's an awkward decision, but it opened the door to this whole line of cases that we call the water company cases or public utility cases that we'll see in Strauss versus Bell Realty next class. So think about Moak when we talk about Strauss. What creates a duty in this case? And in Strauss, we're going to see the duty is created by the contract. The duty is created not because there's a duty, that you have a general duty to run out and supply water to everybody or supply power to everybody. It's a contractual relationship. And as such, there's no duty to other people outside the contract, third parties. So in all of these cases from now, in this class, Moak, Randy V. Murak, and Tarasoff, the question is, when do you have a duty of protection to someone with whom you have absolutely no relationship based on some kind of prior relationship with another person? Here, the prior relationship with the water company was with the city. No, based on this, and it's a huge policy, and all of these next three cases are big policy. It's a huge policy decision that no duty. And so we'll talk about Moak more when we talk about Strauss, but just keep that in mind. So then we moved on to Randy V. Murak. Again, our four defendants tried to say, well, this wasn't a situation of misfeasance. It was just nonfeasance. We just omitted to say the bad things. And our court said, oh, no, this cannot be. You knew about this fellow. You knew about this child molester. Your letters were vital in having the school district hire this child molester. So you were under no duty to answer the request for letters of recommendation. But once you did, you had to behave reasonably. And they're saying, oh, no, it's not a case of misfeasance. It's just nonfeasance. It's not that we didn't do something wrong. We didn't create fraud. We just didn't say anything bad. It was just that we didn't say the bad stuff. And the court said, you know, got around this and said, well, you said plenty of, you made affirmatively false statements. So that's certainly misleading. You made affirmatively false statements by saying he was such a great employee. Obviously, he wasn't a great employee. He was an employee that four school districts got rid of. The question, you know, the court talks a lot about ways to establish duty. It's not, that's not really, I want you to think about those things. It's not, you know, this is the law or this, these are the rules now. These are things that courts will consider when they're imposing an affirmative duty of care when one wouldn't have ordinarily existed. Of course, the situation here where you have a child molester is a serious one and is one that's going to make courts want to have a policy against giving great recommendations for child molesters to school districts. But they talk about some other things. What makes a you know, why is there a duty here? They talk about foreseeability. You know that there's foreseeable that there's going to be an injury. Why is it different here than in my hypothetical with Matazar telling me he's going to beat up Constant? It's foreseeable there too. Well, they had a relationship with this guy. They put the guy in the, it's not a special relationship, it's not a duty to the guy, but they put the guy in that job. Regardless, you know, I had nothing to do with Matazar and Constant. It's happenstance that I knew that something was going to come about, and that didn't, just that happenstance didn't create a duty of care on my part to warn. They talked about insurance. What's that all about? Well, you're not going to insure against child molesters. You know, it's not the end of the world if you say no tort liability in the Moat case, because there's the availability of fire insurance. So if we don't find liability in Moat, they had other options. If we don't find liability here, everybody goes scot-free. Our injured child has no recourse, and these crazy four school districts have no punishment. So, and remember, our tort system wants there to be compensation and deterrence. So, no compensation, no deterrence, unless we find a duty in this case. So think about what created the duty. It was there's a duty to somebody with whom they had no contact. Taking a back a step, liability to someone you don't know. Same way with Moak, liability to someone with whom they had no relationship. And again, we're talking about, we're moving into a situation, duty to protect against, to protect someone against injuries that will be committed by a third person. We're not committing the injury ourselves. It's committing them injuries about a third person. So it's even more complicated than Harper v. Herman, most definitely. More complicated than Tarasov. When do you have a duty to someone you don't even know based on something you know about a third party? So in this case, they didn't enable him. They didn't enable the child molester to do this, but they facilitated it. Their letters put that child molester in that job, and I think that's where the court's discussing it. They didn't have a relationship to the plaintiff, and they didn't have much of a relationship to the dangerous person, but they knew something. So foreseeability and causal connection, moral blame, it's a big one. Insurance is available, public policy, prevent child abuse. Preventing foreseeable injury is more important. So again, think about what we're talking about. This is the first time we've talked about foreseeability. Foreseeability in and of itself doesn't create a duty. Remember, it was foreseeable that Mazar would beat up Constant, but that didn't create a duty. So when we talk about foreseeability here, and how it's used in a policy way to limit liability or expand liability, think about foreseeability again when we start talking about proximate cause and how foreseeability is a commonality, a common term that you see both between duty and proximate cause. We're going to see this again. And duty and proximate cause, I'll start talking about it now, have something in common. And what's that? That they both can, are their policy matters to limit or expand liability. And then we finish talking about Tarasoff, a very controversial case. And here a duty of care was placed on the psychotherapist, duty of care to the families of a victim, of the patient of the psychotherapist. Our psychotherapist knew that something, knew that the patient was threatening a specific person, and had gone to the police, had done other things, had done what he considered his responsibility. Yet when the patient then kills the victim, and there was a threat against this very specific victim, the psychotherapist is now held to a duty of reasonable care to the victim's family. They said that he should have warned them, duty of reasonable care to the family, to the third party. And again, a big policy question, big policy matter here. And psychotherapists all over the country were made insane by this case because they said, well, it breaches all of our confidentiality and now nobody would act out in the therapy situations. Well, this case has been on for 30 years, and you know the world hasn't ended, so it's been construed very narrowly. Look at the Bella, look at the Thompson cases after that. Narrow construction for this case, that in order to, and it's a policy question, in order to prevent a serious, you know, it's not just somebody fantasizing about someone, but it was death. In order to prevent this killing, there's going to be a basis for a duty of care to the third party. And the relationship to the source of harm is the basis, the knowledge, the ability to control, the ability to protect, and the knowledge of the threat. So why is this different from me and Mattis are in Constant? I don't have much of an ability. I have a knowledge of the threat, but my relationship to either one of them does not reach the stat and not reach the level that I can control Mattis are. I have no official relationship, official status that rises to the level of control. I could do it, you know, maybe if I did, then I should, but my duty does not reach to protecting that third party, to protecting Constant. So again, Tarasoff, even after Tarasoff, hasn't changed my ability, hasn't changed my relationship to the source of the harm. But think about Bella and Thompson. This is a very narrow case, and hasn't been extended. So next class, we're going to look at affirmative duties, continuing there, and we're going to talk about the case. We're going to talk about the case and when does a duty, why and when does a duty of care come about because of a statute.